Okay, people are still coming on, but it's time to start. As always, I just want to take a few minutes to respond to some questions. I had mentioned a while ago, the last semester already, that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik didn't wear rabbinic garb. So someone wanted me to explain how I knew that. Well, actually, Rabbi Soloveitchik himself speaks about it. If you look in the book, The Rav, Drashos HaRav, translated by his name is Lustiger, Arnold Lustiger, on page 98, Rav says that my grandfather never wore rabbinic garb because he insisted that what he wore at home must be the same as what he wore in public. And if you look in Making of a Gadol, on pages 1285 and on, he discusses this in some detail. In fact, he brings a proof that Rav Chaim offered to explain why he didn't wear rabbinic garb. The Talmud asks, it's in Masachas Brachos, how did the, if you remember the story of Elisha and the Shunammite woman, the Talmud says, she called him a holy man, so the Talmud says, how did she know that he was a part of a prophet? And they ask, how did she know that? And Rav Chaim says, obviously he wasn't wearing special garb, or else there wouldn't be a question. You can see more stuff about his reasons for not wearing rabbinic garb in Making of a Gadol. Someone asked me an interesting question. I gave my thoughts about Das Torah, and how it really is, if I would use the word politics, but in a sense it's predetermined, because I said that if Rav Yashiv himself were to declare tomorrow, for example, that everyone should be a Zionist, it's not like people would all of a sudden in his world would start listening to him. And someone asked, well, is that my idea, or did I see it anywhere else? And, well, it is my idea, but I also saw it elsewhere. Here is a sefer called Karyana de Igrita Harta of the Stipor, who was the premier spokesman before Shach in the Haredi world, the Das Torah authority. And if you look in volume 1, this is on page 221, he has a correspondence with the Eda Haredit. Now, the Eda Haredit were opposed, obviously, to voting in any elections, and they thought that he was somewhat sympathetic to their cause, so they wrote to him protesting that he published a letter saying that everyone should vote. That's the Das Torah. You have to vote for a good Yisrael. And in his reply to them, and they thought that his letter was going to affect their followers. The Haredi people might now start voting. So what he explains, it's not going to affect them. They have their own rabbanim. But then he says something very interesting. He says that at the end of the day, people don't listen to what the rabbis say if they're not convinced anyway. This is what they want. He says, "Ki alaniyustaiti." In my opinion, afilu es das habeistin tzedekul yishmu. He says they won't even listen to the Eda Haredi's beistin if this beistin hayamora or vasha mitzvah tzviya. That is, if the Eda Haredi leaders, the Haredi, were to all of a sudden say that everyone should go to the polls and vote, Rav Yashiv says, well, they wouldn't listen to that Das Torah either. Why? And he says, how you take it posthumous of Beis Din? They would immediately postle the Beis Din of the Eda Haredi. Now, how is that possible? If they hold the Das Torah and they're Gedolim or the Eda Haredis and the Eda Haredis vote, why don't they listen to them? And Rav Yashiv says, Ki ha'ikar shekolachad v'chad somech ha'masha bora ba'enaf v'yatzmo. He says the essence of the matter is that every person, this is the Ikar, everyone already relies upon what they assume is correct anyway, and then they find an authority to hang it on. And if all of a sudden they don't like what this authority says, well, it's not that they follow that authority, they just throw that authority out and get someone else. So Rav Yashiv is saying that at the end of the day, people make up their own Das Torah, and find what they think should be the Das Torah, and then they find the authorities. Now, he believes, obviously, Rav Disciple, he believes, obviously, that his Das Torah is the proper one, but he also recognizes that the people who hold it have come to this beforehand, and they just assume that he's going to express the Das Torah, but if he says something that they don't like, it's the Hamonam will determine who the Gadol is, not the Gadol determine. So that's, as I said, you can find this in a Disciple. I think it's quite... Well, no, wearing a long jacket doesn't mean anything. Lots of people wore long jackets, but the rabbis had special hats and special garbs. You often see he wears like a little cap. Simcha Zelig is famous for wearing that. I don't know if we could always tell on the pictures what we mean by a long jacket. They were jackets. They were made of special material, and especially special hats. And Reb Chaim never wore any of these. Yes, thank you, Baruch. I meant the stifler. A couple more minutes before we get to 9:10. One of you asked me about this. I mentioned the case of Rav Metzger and Rav Yashav appointing him, and you wanted to know what page is that on, or if it's in the book. And it actually is. It's on page 220, where the book explains that Rav Yashav's opinion is that they wanted to know why he supported. They're clearly referring to Metzger versus Rabbi Ariel for the chief rabbinate. They wanted to know why he supported a figure who was not a great posek, and there was a Talmud Chacham, a greater Talmud Chacham, opposed to him. And Rav Yashav replied that this tafkid, that is this position, this is the chief rabbinate, sarach leyot rak pakid, v'dvarim mesuyamin. We don't need a posek. We just need someone who's a functionary. And therefore, we have to find the best functionary. I thank the person who corrected my Hebrew pronunciation. I just have this yeshivish pronunciation, the biography of Rav Yashav, HaTorah HaMesamachat, which is correct, not HaMesamechas. I, unfortunately, have only a yeshiva education. In fact, when I was at in graduate school, Professor Twersky would always call on me to read, and he always would correct me. So the pronunciation, one day a new edition of the Asai Kreskas, his Or Hashem, came out, and it's vocalized. As Art Scroll says, it was vowelized. Art Scroll invented that word. It had nekudot. So he called on me once to read, and I said to him that he's not going to be able to correct me this time. So he said, he's not going to be able to correct my pronunciation. And he said, why not? And I held up the new volume, which I just bought, and I said, this is a new edition of the Or Hashem. It's menikid. And I think that was the only time in the 7 or 8 years I knew him that he actually smiled. Okay, one more point before we begin. Dovi Hoffman, I don't know if he's with us now. He's been with us a few semesters. He called my attention to something really interesting that I want to share it with you. You can check it out on HebrewBooks.org. There's a sefer called Tiferes Adam by Rabbi Ostreicher. That's actually his great-great-grandfather. And it has an introduction, Hakdama. Remember we spoke a good deal about antinomianism? And I answered a number of questions from people about antinomianism. I have many more sources. If we keep going and we get into the 18th century, deal with Hasidus, we can deal with more of that. But there is an amazing introduction here. It tells a story of how a Hasidus Rebbe came to a city. And he was eating with the Rav, and a fly flew into his stew or his soup, and he took the fly apparently was dead, and he took after he flew in, he took it out and threw it out. And the Rav says to him, how could you do this? It's Borer, taking the psoas out. And the Chassidish Rebbe replied that I saw, he said that this shulchan, this table is holy to Hashem, and I saw that this fly needed a tikkun. And therefore, I had to take it out. Now, that in and of itself is quite antinomian. And then it talks about how the Rav starts screaming at him that this is Chilul Shabbos. And they get into a big dispute, and the Chassidish Rebbe says that when I reach my city, Seget, I'll be able to talk to you'll come visit me, we'll sit and talk, and we'll discuss this. And the Rav says, not only don't I want to talk to you, I hope that you don't even make it there alive. It goes through the whole story here, and then it deals with some more antinomianism about, it turns out, at least this is the story, the son of this Rav ended up committing suicide, and the Tzanzer Rav gave him a hesped, and everyone wanted to know about how could he do that. And the Tzanzer Rav talks about how this person thought that he was going to commit some sin, and the Tzanzer Rav claims that if you think you're going to commit a sin, it's okay to commit suicide, and you're really a holy person, and it goes on and on, all about antinomianism. And then the Rav, who's a posek, a Hungarian posek, starts discussing this, and he wants to justify what Chassidish Rebbe did about throwing out the fly. And listen to this. he says that as his justification why this is not borer, he says that the Rebbe dano soka ochel. He said that since this fly nefesh zeh tahar v'tov, because this fly was holy or it needed a tikkun, therefore it's not regarded as psolus. It's not regarded as something like a bad thing, garbage or anything like that. It's actually a holy fly, and therefore he was permitted to pull it out. Like I said, this is real antinomianism, and you can understand how the rub of the community is crazy. He gives another story here about how some other chassid Rebbe would be riding in this carriage outside its home right before Shabbos, and the guy starts screaming at him. Like I said, this is classic chassidic antinomianism. Hopefully we'll get back to it. I want to now pick up, and we will conclude with Eliezer Berkovitz. Might even get to Rabbi Chaim Moser Grzynski today. I have some more things I want to get to, but we'll do that next week. There's one more book I want to discuss briefly that deals with Eliezer Berkovitz and Jewish law. And that is the one you see here, Jewish Women in Time and Torah. It was the last book that Berkovitz published in 1990. He passed away in 92. The only time I ever met Berkovitz was, I believe it was 1989, if I'm not mistaken, 88. And he had the finished book in manuscript on his death. Again, we spoke about it. To get a sense of the man and his outlook at the end of his life, because just like Emanuel Rachman, Berkovitz moved to the left. As he saw that the Orthodox world was not welcoming to his proposals and his ideas, and especially as he saw that the Orthodox world was moving so much to the right, he didn't just stay still, as some people did. You speak to people like Rabbi Mark Angel and others, they tell you that they haven't changed. They have just stood still. Mark Angel was the RCA president in the 1980s. It's that the rest of Orthodoxy has moved to the right. You cannot say that about Berkovitz. Berkovitz unquestionably moved left. And if you no longer feel you have a community, then you're able to put forth ideas that you wouldn't put forth before because you were trying to reach consensus. Once you conclude that there is not going to be consensus, you can develop in different ways. This is how he ends this book. How he begins the book. It's not our intention in this work to plead the cause of Jewish women against the numerous Jewish laws that today are rightly considered unfair or even unjust. Note that he refers to laws that he says today are considered unfair and unjust. It's very hard to find Orthodox rabbis who will acknowledge, even if they believe it, they won't acknowledge it, and most of the time they don't even believe it. It's very hard to find an Orthodox rabbi to say that Jewish law, either in large measure or even in small measure, is unjust or unfair. And then to anyone even, that was one of the unique aspects of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg that I mentioned in my book on him, that he is willing to acknowledge that certain parts of Jewish law trouble him, trouble his conscience. He thinks they're wrong. They were decided incorrectly. This ties in with a major theme of Berkovitz, that Jewish law doesn't stand still. That what was appropriate in one era is no longer appropriate today, and we saw that this is not Reform Judaism or even Conservative Judaism, because he believes that all this is inherent in the system. How does he do this? Crucial to his argument is that he distinguishes between different phases of Jewish history regarding women. The first is what he calls Torah tolerated, which means that women in society in general were treated very poorly, and the Torah cannot change this overnight. You have a society where women are treated really bad. The Torah comes onto the scene with the revelation. It can't all of a sudden start legislating the way it would like to in the best of all possible worlds. It has to deal with the reality and try to improve the status of women dealing with the society they're in. But the understanding that as time goes on, this situation will improve even more and more. It's obviously the argument used to justify slavery and many things else. And this is obviously based, and he quotes it, on the Rambam's conception that certain mitzvot were given not with the end result in mind, but with the situation of where the people were. Sacrifices, for example. Rambam points out that the people were so attached to this form of worship that this is what the only way they could relate to God. So therefore, since they were attached to this pagan type of worship, rather than rejecting it entirely, which would leave them no way to connect to God, instead, this pagan worship is turned into a holy form of worship by directing everything towards God. This is famous for the Rambam. The Rambam's not the only one to use it. And the Eri uses this about various halachot, well, one halach in particular, but you could use it about others, in Chazal. The Meiri says that the prohibition of zugot, pairs, this idea that you can't do things in pairs, you can't ask for two cookies or whatever it is. The question is then how do you have the four cups? Aren't these pairs? So there's the Talmud, you have a discussion over this. The Meiri says that Chazal knew this was a superstition, and yet this was a popular superstition, and what Chazal did was they took a superstition that the people were attached to and they couldn't get rid of it. And instead of keeping it connected to paganism and pagan ideas, they direct it to Jewish ideas. So, in this case, I wouldn't say Jewish ideas. They direct it to ideas that are not involved with paganism. What was the issue of a zugot? It was dualism, things like that. So instead, you put it into something harmless. Say that zugot, it's not about dualism, two gods or anything like that. It's simply about that there's demons or something that could affect you. So you neutralize the idolatrous element and just leave it with the superstitious element, which is really harmless, according to Meiri, because according to him, the intellectuals will know that demons are nonsense and it's harmless. And if the masses, since they're the one who are so connected to these things, better have them connected to a superstition, which is meaningless, than have them connected to an idolatry. So what does Berkovitz do with this? Well, he begins by showing that traditionally women were subservient to men, both halakha and society. If you look in the traditional sources, women are regarded as secondary. They must obey their husbands. Yeah, David, good point. You have many examples. Berkovitz has no problem saying that the Midrash assumes that women have less intelligence than men. Again, this is not the sort of thing you usually see in books written by Orthodox writers on women. Almost always, they're apologetic in nature. So much so, these books are also apologetic, and there's nothing wrong with apologetics. It, of course, depends on the audience. If you're speaking to younger people, if you're speaking to people newly religious, there's a place for apologetics. But some books, which should be offer the complete treatment, and the non-apologetic also are apologetic. It got to be so bad that there's a rabbinic journal called Or Yisrael. Comes out of Muncie. It's really, it's a Hasidim, Haredi journal. They have a lot of interesting stuff. But they had a couple articles about the trend in rabbinic literature, in writings today, and not just in modern Orthodox. I'm not referring to modern Orthodox, they're Haredi literature, in which apologetics has started to distort what they call Torah truths. And they gave some examples. One example is you'll find in Haredi literature, English literature, I don't think you find this in Hebrew literature, where people write about how the reason that men have a bris milah is because men are not complete. Men are not pure. Women are born complete, perfect. Men, however, are not perfect, and therefore they need to do the bris milah to become perfect. In other words, a woman is more perfect than a man. So I guess if you think it's bad to say that a man is more perfect than a woman, I don't know why all of a sudden it becomes better to say a woman is more perfect than a man. So one person writes in there that this is blasphemy. The bris milah is the greatest mitzvah given to man. It's a chance, it's the sign of the covenant, or it is the covenant. And unfortunately for women, they don't have the opportunity for this great zechus. So here, these apologist writers have taken what was given as an incredible zechus for men to be able to fulfill the covenant, which represents, you know, God and the Jewish people. And instead of saying that, they turn this into something that men have to do because they're not born perfect. That's one example. They also, one of the writers, a writer from England, picked up on how all this discussion about the bracha Shasani Kirtsono, and that a woman is really higher than a man because a man has to, a woman is happy with who she is, all sorts of things, that all the justifications they give. And this author says, okay, you can say all these things, but how come no one ever cites the Torah? Of course, says that women make this bracha Shasani Kirtsono in order to justify themselves, God's din, as it were, that is, they're in a bad situation. They were born women, and therefore they make this bracha to say, even though we're born women, okay, we thank, you know, just like we thank, praise God for the good, we praise God for the bad. And then if you're going to write books, you have to give all the perspectives. And it goes on and on. The Maharal is, I know Yisrael Kashkin has discussed in previous classes, the Maharal, what they do with the Maharal. So Berkovitz is trying to be honest and say, and that this is what, at least what he believes, the viewpoint was. As I said, I believe apologetics have a place, but you need to be honest. You need to be open. If you're talking about the views of the Rishonim, for example, it's great to talk about those Rishonim that have very good views of them, just like in rabbinic literature. On the other hand, it's not fair to leave out the ones, I know Nechama Leibowitz never would teach Abarbanel in the beginning of Reishis. So she was personally offended by it, because Abarbanel discusses the Vayivra Elohim Es Adam, God created man. Tzelem Elokim, Tzelem Tzelem Demus Tamdiso. And Abarbanel on that pasuk says that Adam, man, was created with Tzelem Elokim. Woman was not created with Tzelem Elokim. I think all of us will find this not just outrageous, but really backwards. And but it should, of course, be taught to show what the Abarbanel's position was. I would, for me, and I've mentioned this before, this is very easy. Abarbanel, I would say, was simply influenced by the Christian environment he was in. Aquinas, who Abarbanel knew, his writings, had very negative views of women. He followed Aristotle, that woman, a woman. You can give all any explanation you want, and I think it, from our perspective, it comes out very well to say that Abarbanel was, in this matter, unfortunately, adopted a Christian view. They always had very negative views of women. It's funny, though, because someone actually wrote about this in one of Rav Avinir's works. He deals with this Abarbanel. And someone had wrote to him and expressed his very viewpoint, which I just said, which I think is the best limud tzfus for the Abarbanel. I would hate to think that he would you could actually derive from the Torah that a woman is not created Tzelem Elokim. It makes me feel much better to say that this is a Christian idea that seeped into Abarbanel. And Rav Avinir, though, sees this as a denigration of Abarbanel. He rejects this. He says, of course, we don't accept the Abarbanel's position. We accept the position that women are created Tzelem Elokim. But don't tell me that the Abarbanel could have been influenced by Christian ideas. That's a terrible thing to say. It's just a different shita. I find this quite strange, because to actually assume that we're going to have an argument whether a woman is created with Tzelem Elokim, and we're going to say, okay, well, the Abarbanel says that that's a Torah viewpoint, and but the majority say otherwise, so we don't go like the Abarbanel. To me, the honor of Judaism and of the Abarbanel is much better served than saying that in this matter he really was misled. But as I said, Rav Avinair thinks differently. I don't think the Abu Dharam says that. The Abu Dharam says, correct me if I'm wrong, the Abu Dharam says that in fact, he doesn't say it. The Abu Dharam says that a woman is meshubedet to her husband. That is, she is like a servant to her husband under his authority, and therefore she can't... he says that about Mitzvah Seh Shez Mangrama. I don't recall if he says. He might say that about Shezana Kitsuno as well. I don't recall that. But he does say the reason they don't do Mitzvah Seh Shez Mangrama is not because their bodily clock is more connected to God, and therefore they don't need the mitzvot, any of these things you've heard. It's that they're meshuba to their husband. He can always order them around to do what he wants to do, and therefore how can you tell them they have to daven shacharis today now, because right now they should be making breakfast for their husband or doing whatever he wants. That's what the Abu Dharam. I think in one of those articles in Ar Yisrael, someone quotes the Abu Dharam and gives that as an example. Now, Berkovitz does list some of the negative things said in the Talmud about women. If you're honest, you'll acknowledge that there are negative things said about women in the Talmud, as well as positive things. By the same token, there are negative things said about men in the Talmud, that is, average people, the Amaretz, the ignorant, terrible things said about them, and also better things said about them. There are bad things said about Talmidei Chachamim. There are some stories that make Talmidei Chachamim look so bad. There's a famous story in the Talmud of where a rabbi is riding on a horse and an ugly person goes by him, and he looks at this person and says, basically, you're really ugly. And the person says, well, you know, God made me. This makes this Amora look really terrible, so much so that some have argued, and I think it makes a lot of sense, that you have to understand the Talmud not as a work for the masses. This is a work written by elites for other elites. So the rabbis are talking to other rabbis, and therefore they can include stories in there that make other rabbis look very bad, because this is all discussion in the club. They can make stories that show rabbis as being very arrogant, doing terrible things, and we have plenty of examples of it, as well as obviously the stories that make the rabbis look very good. Because if you see this as a work written by the rabbis for the rabbis, it's a lot different than if this was a work written for the masses. I don't think that, and I'm sympathetic to this position, because I don't think Chazal would portray the rabbis in such a negative way at some points if they expected the masses to actually be reading this, and therefore the masses to get a negative view about the rabbis. Similarly, we find in Rishonim and Acharonim sometimes very negative things about other rabbis. I don't think they would want the masses to be let in on this, because it would lead to a general denigration of Torah, of Bizayon Torah. That's why so many people have said, the Yaakov Emden's great error is that he really created a Bizayon Torah. He didn't just attack another rabbi, Yonason Eibschitz, in his writings. He made a public spectacle of it. And even Gershom Scholem and others have argued that the denigration of rabbinic authority because of the Emden Eibschitz dispute was significant in the rise of Haskalah. I know you still want to hear about Haskalah. Hopefully we'll get to it. Woman is Niknes or something like that. Okay, well, you get, both of them. You have the same thing with Nida laws, by the way. There's an article, someone wrote an article in the Journal of Feminism and Religion, something like that, called From Pot of Filth, I think was it was, From Pot of Filth to Hedge of Roses, describing how perceptions and portrayals of Nida have changed over time. Now, you can find everything in Norman Lamb's Hedge of Roses in the Talmud, just like you can find the other sources. Where you put the stress, though, has changed, obviously, as it should, depending on the atmosphere you're in, the environment you're in. So Berkovitz says, you have all these sources, negative things, let's say, about women. What's the Torah's position? What's the Torah really about? And Berkovitz sees a difference between how women are portrayed in the Torah and how they're portrayed in the rabbinic literature. For example, the Torah tells Abraham, listen to your wife, Sarah. It is Rebecca, Rivka, who sees really the true worth of Yaakov and of Esav, not Yitzhak. Yitzhak is blinded to this. Miriam is a prophetess. And the list goes on. When you get to the rabbis in the Talmud, Berkovitz says, and I don't know if he's correct in this, but he says that you see a much more negative perception, and this is a departure from the Bible. I don't know, because you have positive views also in the Talmud. You don't have that much in the Bible, so you don't have that much room to discuss it. In the Talmud, though, the Talmud's much larger, and you have the Midrashic literature. So it makes sense that you'd have both positive and negative, and you could find negative views also in the Bible, I'm sure. But Berkovitz sees this as a response to the era, really influenced by the era. He compares the rabbinic view of women to the ancient Greek view of women. And he points to similarities in rabbinic literature. And he sees this rabbinic literature as influenced by Greek literature. It's not Torah per se. It's either influenced because the rabbis just were influenced, or this was the environment they were in, this is what they had to adapt to. It's a reflection of the time the rabbis were in. The society that women were in made it that they had no intelligence and made it that they were portrayed so negatively. Halacha had to deal with the society they were in, but this is not what Torah is about, what Torah wants. Incidentally, it's reported by Greek sources, Socrates would make a blessing every day, or he would express his gratefulness. What did Socrates say every day? He was thankful that he was born a man, not an animal. That he was a man, not a woman. He was thankful every day that he was born a human, not an animal, a man, not a woman, and a Greek and not a barbarian. Obviously, we see the similarities here. He was born a human, not an animal, man, not a woman, and Greek, not a barbarian. It's more than a little likely that the brachas we have go back to, I'm not going to say to Socrates, but to a widespread notion in that part of the world that these are certain things you need to be thankful for. Yeah, we would say Shelo Asani Goy. Well, that would correspond to barbarian. And as I said, Berkovitz uses the Rambam's argument with regard to sacrifices. Is there a difference in the Bavli and Hashami? I don't think so. I mean, I'm no expert to go through all that. There's a number of books that have been written on this, and they cite from both Bavli and Hashami. We do have differences. Bavli has more relevant references to demons, things like that. But with regard to women, I'm unaware of any real differences. In my new book, though, I give an example of where the Bavli, this is, I think, great. I'm talking about censorship in traditional literature. And it isn't just censorship in modern times. There is a text in the Bavli, if I'm not mistaken, it's in the Bavli, not in the Halachic Midrash, it's in the Bavli. I haven't worked on this in a while. The Yerushalmi has a text, and it quotes a halacha in the name of a woman, Berdia. And the same halacha is quoted in the Bavli, although the Yerushalmi is an earlier source, the same halacha is quoted in the Bavli, and Berdia's name is deleted. There is no question in my mind that the Masader, that is the organizer of this part of the Bavli, didn't want to attribute a halachic source to a woman, and therefore he deletes her. Or the person, before it got to the Masader, someone deleted the woman because they weren't comfortable with a woman being given credit for passing on halachic teaching. And this is not the only example of this. I don't think you can say that this reflects the Yerushalmi as a whole. So I can't really say per se. Want to say he got it from us? Could be. I don't know. I don't think though Socrates had any connection with any Jews living where he was. I don't think there was any interplay. I'm not saying they got it. All I'm saying is in that era, this was common. If we're going to say that the world picked it up from the Jews, maybe. Could be. I don't know. It is striking, the similarity. I don't know the earliest example, how early the bracha goes in our tradition. Socrates lives quite early, before a lot of these rabbis. So, before the rabbis. So, I don't know. In Jewish Women and Time on Torah, page 49, he writes as follows. He explains how the rabbis offer an innovation in the laws of Kiddushin against what seems to be Torah law. How can the rabbis say one thing versus something else? He says, the reason seems to be that the laws of Kiddushin do not represent the entire Torah. Apart from the right of the husband over divorce, there's another commandment, even more comprehensive and compelling. That one? Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. It could not be disregarded. There was a conflict between the two laws of the Torah. A solution had to be found, and it was found. Its promulgation required a great deal of courage and a deep sense of rabbinical responsibility. The saying is that the rabbis had different forces acting upon them. You have to love thy neighbor as thyself. This was in tension sometimes with certain laws, and the rabbis had to deal with it. There's other things of interest in the book I don't want to get into. He deals, for example, with women's prayer groups. He was the first person to deal with women's prayer groups in English, as far as I know. He supports it. He actually cites Weinberg's permission for the Bas Mitzvah celebration to show that we don't have to be afraid of new customs. He also says that women should have their own mezumen for benching. Here's something where, according to the halacha, most sources, three women who eat together should do a mezumen. Rishon Zalman Aruch was asked about it. He said, yes, they should do a mezumen. It's very uncommon. Maybe among these very learned women today, they'll do a mezumen, but it really wasn't practiced. And you have poskim who say it shouldn't be done, because it now has feminist implications. Berkovitz even goes further, though. He cites Rishonim, from which he derives that you can even include women in the mezumen with men. And if you have five women and five men, you can include them. This is really all I want to deal with on Berkovitz and Halacha. I think you can all see that he really is becoming quite radical. And as time goes on, it does become hard to see how he's really hasn't really moved into the conservative orbit, at least the right-wing conservative orbit. It's very similar, very close. And the language he uses, Jewish law being unfair, that we have to revise Jewish law, that we have the authority to update Jewish law. This has always been the language of right-wing conservative movement. I mean, the conservative movement as a whole, but the right-wing conservative movement was always much more halachically conscious. They wouldn't fall back on conscience. That's always been the conservatives' idea, that's been the conservative idea for the last, I don't know, 50 years, a mainstream idea that when you can't justify something halachically, you can find some, you can fall back on conscience. So, for example, mamzer, divorcee marrying a kohen, they don't need to justify how they reject it halachically, which they can't. They simply say, well, in some areas there's conscience, and that can trump even black letter law. Here, the right-wing conservatives would never go that far, and Berkovitz would never go that far, but the idea that we can reopen what most people thought to be settled law and start updating it, that to most was much too radical, and you could see now why Rabbi Kreisworth, even though Berkovitz was not as radical in the 60s as he was in the late 80s, you can understand why Rabbi Kreisworth was led to say what he said. I do just want to, though, give one final example of Berkovitz relating to halacha, because I think it says a lot about who he was. And even if we choose not to go with Berkovitz, I think we can learn a lot from what I'm going to read you right now. It comes from his a book, Crisis in Judaism. That's the Hebrew title. He has a book with a similar title in English. I don't know if this passage appears in it. I don't think. He tells a story of how he was invited to one of the women's seminaries. When I was young, went to Israel, we used to call them yeshivas for girls. Today, my daughter is going to be going next year to be the most religious Zionist place. They call it seminary. So a women's seminary, and he wasn't invited to a Haredi seminary. He was invited to a Dati seminary. And his talk was, he spoke about Kiddush Hashem and Kiddush HaChayim, sanctifying death and sanctifying life. And he tells a story that he told them about terrible things that happened in World War II, Holocaust. He talks about how one case they split up a mother and her little daughter. So the mother they sent to the side to work, to be kept alive, as a mangler or whoever it was, and the daughter was being sent to the gas chamber. And the mother, seeing what was happening, this is Berkovitz telling the story, rejects this, rejects the possibility to live, grabs her child, and walks with her hand in hand to death. Something that we can all see parents doing. And Berkovitz says, I attempted to explain to these young women that the mother, who wouldn't abandon her daughter, I intend to explain to them that the mother, I'm translating from Hebrew as I speak, the mother would not abandon the daughter because the mother refused to allow the daughter to spend her last moments on earth alone. And by doing that, by giving up her own life, spend her last minutes with her daughter, Berkovitz says, Hikshima atachli chayakein, the mother really fulfilled, brought to fruition the purpose of what it means to be a mother on the most exalted and high level. Kiddush Hashem Bazeh, this type of Kiddush Hashem, is also Kiddush HaChayim, is also sanctifying life, and there's nothing above that, a mother who refuses to allow the child to go to its death by itself. And then Berkovitz says, from the standpoint of the daughters, from the girl students, some of whom were only a couple of years away from being mothers themselves, there was no reaction. Their faces just were blank, without any feeling, without any sense of understanding. That is, he tells this incredible story of how a mother sacrifices herself so that the child doesn't die on its own, and there's no reaction. After the lecture, he says, I asked the teacher, one who was responsible for the tachnit, that is, they were doing a course on the Holocaust, what's the reason? How come the girl sat there, speechless? No expressions. The apathy she saw. How do you explain it? This is sort of apathy from young Jewish women. When faced with this mesirut nefesh, this giving, an avat ima yudit, and the love of a Jewish mother for a child that she's willing to give up her life, and the student sat there with nothing to say, emotionless. The teacher's answer was, the thought, what was going through the heads of these young women, was Ha'imash Asta Aim Haya Api Halacha, was what the mother did in accord with Halacha. That is, instead of being moved emotionally and spiritually by the great sacrifice of the mother, They were all wondering, no, what she did in accordance with halacha. Berkovitz says, nidhamti midvarav. I was shocked by what he said. And more. I was shocked more by the hardness of heart of these students. Ribono shel olam, hayim zoi halacha? Is this what Jewish law is all about? Eze min halacha morim b'machon hazeh. What type of halacha, what type of Jewish law are they teaching in this institution? Ha'im yesh p'giyach ha'mura yoter ba'archa ha'musari shalacha b'divrei ha'machanei chadati hazeh? Can you distort, defame, destroy? I don't know how to explain it. The moral essence of Jewish law more than this teacher, he says, hadati, he puts it in quotes. This is what Berkovitz was troubled with later years. That you can become so hung up on halacha and the nitty-gritty that you miss the forest for the trees. You're not even moved anymore by a mother who's not going to let her child die. And you start asking questions about halacha. We've discussed this on numerous occasions in this class before. We dealt with it with Rabbi Weinberg and other figures. The idea that there's a sense of the faithful that sometimes has to overcome and override halachic nitty-gritty. From Berkovitz's perspective, you don't ask questions like this. Just like when you look at the other martyrs, you don't ask, the Baalei HaTosfos never asked when they saw these people who even kill their own children, is what they are doing halachically proper. Were they allowed to commit suicide and kill their children? That's for the scholars. But for the people in the time, they're just filled with admiration. And of course, dealing with the Holocaust, when Berkovitz tells a story like this, to have the girls, at least this is what the teacher said, be more concerned about the halachic propriety of this, instead of, that means that they were no longer capable of appreciating Jewish values from the heart. Everything was cerebral. Everything was coming through the head. And that, according to Berkovitz, is a terrible distortion of what Judaism is all about. It's not all about the head. It's not all about intellectual calculations. It's about the heart. And Jewish law needs to speak to the heart as well. And that's really what drives so much of his writings. Okay, I want to now move on to the final area that Berkovitz dealt with. That is the Holocaust. And although he hasn't had much influence on Jewish law, he's really been pushed aside, pushed out of the canon, I think we could say, of accepted Orthodox thinkers, when it comes to Holocaust theology, which is a field of, it's a huge field, he really is a central figure. This is his most famous book, Faith of the Holocaust. He wrote other things as well. All you have to do is look at any of the works dealing with post-Holocaust theology, and Berkovitz is front and center as putting forth a traditional perspective. See some non-traditional perspectives, be it Elie Wiesel or Richard Rubinstein. So what are the major points? We don't have time to go into it in great detail, but what are Berkovitz's major points? Then we can talk a little, maybe, you know, was he original? He didn't think he was original. He thought that he was simply expressing traditional view how to deal with a tragedy like the Holocaust. But let's see. Obviously, many people have tried to explain the Holocaust. That's what theodicy is. What does theodicy mean? It means to defend the goodness of God in the face of evil. All religious people are confronted with theodicy. It goes in our Bible. We have the book of Job, which is one of the classic treatments of theodicy. I sometimes wonder who is more troubled by terrible things. The non-believer, the atheist, let's say, because he has no reason to expect anything else. Or the religious person, because this troubles the believer, this troubles the believer's faith. I don't think you can set straight rules on this, because sometimes it's precisely believers who are able to find answers, or if not answers, comfort in their tradition. But there's plenty of people who try to defend theodicy. Famous book in the 1980s, Lawrence Kushner, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And in the Orthodox world especially, you have numerous examples of books. But people have the answers. I'm talking about both books and obviously religious spokesmen. They can tell you why there was a Hurricane Katrina. They can tell you all sorts of things. They can tell you why there was volcanic ash spreading out all over Europe, because this enabled some bacher who was in a in Europe to get a kidney transplant because all the people who were supposed to fly in to get it weren't able to, not mentioning, obviously, all the people who died who couldn't get their kidney transplants. But the Odyssey is a... And it's a reputable, field. Great thinkers from our tradition, from medieval times and on, have tried to deal with it. Some don't like to deal with it at all. Rabbi Soloveitchik, for example, refused to be involved in theodicy. He thought that the only answer is say you have no answer, that this is beyond us. And that's really what the book of Job is. If you can summarize the book of Job, it is that... I think maybe this is how you summarize it. For the believer, there are no questions. That is, I think some people have said for the non-believer, there are no answers. For the believer, there are no questions. Because in the book of Job, if you recall the story, Job starts out, he has everything, he loses everything. Children die. Obviously, the story is not a literal story, although the Talmud disputes this, and the Rambam adopts the opinion that it's a parable. There is an opinion that it's not, but if you just look at the story, al pi hapshat, there is no question in the world this is not meant to be taken literally. It's impossible. Al pi hapshat. And that's why the Rambam agrees with the opinion of the Talmud. It says this, lo hayav lo nivra, that this is not a real story. He's not even portrayed as a Jewish person. He loses everything. And why did he lose it all? Job is very angry. He's angry at God. And one of his friends start trying to explain what happened. And one of his friends tells him that the reason this happened to you is because you sinned. That's the classic answer. We hear it so often today. Why is there a Holocaust? Because the Jews sinned. Why do these bad things happen? Because they sinned. And at the end of the book of Job, God appears out of the whirlwind. And he explains his answer to Job. But he also rebukes the friends for all their answers. And he says they've spoken falsely. So the friends who are saying that the reason you suffered so much is because of your sins, God himself rejects that. The book of Job is very important because the Bible is here rejecting the notion that suffering has to be explained as on account of sin. It's possible it could be on account of sin, but what the book of Job tells us is that there is no way to know this. It is impossible to know this, and therefore it should not be explained this way. If you want to assume, if you're the one suffering and you want to assume, it might be because of my sins, that's between you and God, then you'll work on yourself and that's for you. But it is impossible, so testifies the Sefer, Eov, to point to someone else and say, this is happening because of a sin. God himself says, cannot say this. And why not? Because then God explains that, were you there, Job, when I created the world, when I put the sun in the heavens and all this? What he's saying is that for man to understand God, it's like saying that an ant can understand physics. That we're such a tiny cog in this enormous machine. There are reasons for why things happen. The book is not nihilistic. It's not saying that there's no reasons. What it's saying is, however, we can never even begin to understand these reasons. They're beyond our ken by definition because we're human. And what Job finds in the end is comfort because he recognizes that God is there. Not that he understands God, and not that he understands God's ways, but God has not abandoned him. It's not that he did evil, this happened. There are reasons he can't understand it, but God is with him. And that's why Rabbi Soloveitchik said that this whole endeavor of theodicy is doomed, because we already have our tradition from the book of Job that we are not supposed to attempt to answer these things because we can't. Instead, we are supposed to attempt, and it's a very high level, obviously, but we're supposed to get to the place where even with the pain and the difficulty, we can be at one with God. This is how the Rambam explains the highest level of divine providence. It says, 1,000 fall to the right of you and 10,000 to the left, and harm will not come unto you. It doesn't mean that physical harm won't come unto you, as the commentaries explain. Of course, the righteous people suffer like everyone else. It means it won't come near you, it won't affect you. Because you understand that the righteous person knows that physical ailments are all external, and his spirit is not crushed. Despite the physical ailments, he keeps his faith. That's what the verse in Psalm means, that it shall not come near you. That is, it does not affect your faith. Yes, and William is absolutely correct. And that's what Job derives. That we recognize that you know, God has his reasons, we can never understand it, and we move on from there. In our day and age, be it value human life, to create a state of Israel, whatever it is, but it's a fool's errand to even begin to have to explain why bad things happen to good people. But most people weren't satisfied with that. They felt that they had to offer some sort of explanations. And many people thought that there couldn't be faith after the Holocaust, which is why Berkowitz titled his book the way he did. The whole movement of the death of God comes about after that. When you have a tragedy, we've all had tragedies. Our families, I'm pretty sure that all of us have had tragedies in our families, and if we haven't, we know people who have had tragedies. And people often ask, why did God do this? This is obviously universal. Famous story with the Buddha. A woman comes to the Buddha and says her child had died. And she wanted to know from the Buddha. This is a great story because instead of the Buddha, if you substituted the Besht or someone else, the Baal Shem Tov, you could publish it in an Art Scroll Gedolim book. The Buddha says to her, I want you to go to every house in the town and collect a mustard seed from every house in the town where they haven't had a tragedy. She goes around, and by going to every house, knocking on every door, she learns that every single house, everyone she knows, has had a tragedy of some sort. And when she comes back to the Buddha, she understands that that's the answer, that there is no way of explanation. That this is the way the world is, and what we need to do is learn to live with it, because by definition, the world is made in such a way that there are going to be tragedies, and we can't avoid it. And as William says, the question is what to do about it. So getting back to the question I asked, why are these tragedies? People ask them. Many people won't be satisfied with the Buddha's answer. Well, from the outset, we need to distinguish between so-called natural tragedies, earthquakes, let's say, volcanoes, things like that, typhoons, tornadoes, and man-made disasters, mass murder. Most people will find it easier to attribute to God, the first to God, that is, a tsunami, you can attribute that to God, rather than the second, that is mass murder or any type of murder. But when you look at it more closely, even with regard to the so-called natural tragedies, we can often identify cause and effect, thus removing God from the picture in the same way as if an individual pulled the trigger. It used to be that the weather was thought to come from God. That's what people thought, storms. Now we can anticipate, not perfectly, obviously, but we can anticipate certain things. We know we can anticipate earthquakes. We know when things are going to happen. To a much larger extent than ever before. Our predictions are not 100% accurate, but you get the point. And after the fact, we can almost always push it back. So to say that God caused it, fundamentally everything is caused by God if you're a believer, but we can identify the immediate cause. Let us speak about the Holocaust in particular. But it did seem to many people that the Holocaust was different, that the Holocaust raised the issue of theodicy to new heights. Although there had been answers before, questions of theodicy, the Holocaust had raised it to new heights. Now, I will tell you that I personally am not at all sympathetic to the whole field of post-Holocaust theology because I think it is based on a methodological error. I do not believe that the Holocaust raises any problems of theodicy that were not already there. If a child is born with a terrible disease, or if a child is murdered, the moral problem is the same as if 1 million children were killed. Maybe not in the popular mind, but in the philosophical mind, it's the exact same. There is only a difference in degree, not in kind, to use philosophical terminology. The good God must be defended if even one child is born with leukemia. Because if you believe in a God of infinite goodness and a completely good God, then his goodness is challenged. You know, if he's a little bit bad, that means he's not completely good. That's the same thing whether it's one child he kills or a million children. The problem of theodicy is the exact same philosophical perspective. God's goodness needs to be defended in either case. So as far as I'm concerned, if the old theodicy wasn't satisfying, then the new theodicy isn't. And if the old theodicy is satisfying, it should be satisfying even with a million. Obviously, we're more affected by a million. The numbers are more. Speaking about absolutes, moral absolutes, which God is, absolute goodness, even one child being born defeats that, unless we find a way of justifying it. So we're going to focus on the Holocaust, because that's what Berkowitz is writing about, although the insights, which I'm going to give you now from Berkowitz, could be used for any examples of theodicy. Berkowitz states, first of all, and he's speaking now about a man-made tragedy. That's his focus here. Berkowitz is not speaking about issues of earthquakes and leukemia. We'll get back to that at the end, because the same insights, you can say kal vachomer, all the more so. If the world is created in the way that Berkowitz can explain mass murder, you can similarly explain the other aspects of suffering. Berkowitz says simply, we don't need to explain why God brought the Holocaust. Many people were offering explanations or asking questions, why did God bring the Holocaust? Berkowitz says we don't need to explain this because God did not bring the Holocaust. I don't know if it was the standard view, but the traditional view was the Holocaust was a punishment for sins of various sorts. Towards the end of their lives, the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Shach actually got in a debate on this point. Rav Shach, in one of his speeches, spoke about how the Holocaust was a punishment for the sins. And that's the traditional view, Mimnechata'enu. And from Rav Shach's perspective, if this can explain the destruction of the temple, if it can explain all these other things, if you look in the Crusades, the Piyutim, they explained it based on the sins of the Jews, then why can't it explain the Holocaust? Particularly, Rav Shach is operating from a very sophisticated position. The Holocaust is just greater in numbers. And I don't even know, by the way, if the Holocaust is greater in percentage. One-third of all Jews were killed. What percentage of Jews were killed in the Crusades? What do they think? There's 100,000 Jews in all of Europe and maybe half a million or a million outside of Europe? Well, obviously, percentage-wise, the numbers are less, but in terms of the Ashkenazic population, the numbers might have been the equivalent. I don't know. But Berkowitz rejects this approach, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe gave a very strong attack on Rav Shach's position, saying that about the Holocaust, you cannot say that it was because of sins, that they're all holy. Fortunately, Lubavitcher Rebbe, though, didn't explain, well, if this logic was used for earlier tragedies, why not for the Holocaust? But Berkowitz rejects this approach out of hand, that is Rav Shach's perspective, and he would reject also the medieval Paitonim, no question about it. From Berkowitz's perspective, evil people acting from their free will perpetrated the Holocaust. They are responsible for it, not God. The analogy is simple. If I pick up a knife and I stab myself, no one is going to say that God caused that. It's the exact same thing if I pick up a knife and I stab my neighbor. God did not cause it. I did it. The problem of the Holocaust, Berkowitz says, is not the problem of theodicy, defending God's goodness. We're not concerned with that because God's goodness doesn't need to be defended. The problem is the problem of free will. Why do we have a world, why did God create a world, that people were given free will and they can exercise it to do such horrible things? Presumably, I must believe, obviously, I think even more than presumably, there is a reason for this. God created the world. He has his reasons. We don't understand that people were to be created with free will. God creates humanity. He has a reason for creating humanity. By definition, humanity needs free will. We could have all been created as automatons, but then we can't accomplish anything. If you don't have an evil inclination, then good is not good. Good is only good in the presence of bad. If you're able to do something, you have a choice and you can achieve. God wants humanity achieve great things. For whatever reason, that's what God wants. And by definition, great things can only be achieved. People can only rise to heights of greatness, spiritual greatness, all the types of greatness, in the face of an alternative. And people need to be given this free will. Asking why there is free will is the same thing as asking why God created man. Can't explain why God created man. By definition, the creation of man means there is free will. And by the same token, just as no one feels compelled to explain why if I give my friend a shirt, and he likes the shirt, it's a nice shirt, everyone's going to say, well, I did a nice thing, I gave him a shirt. No one is going to think to say that God gave him the shirt. What kind of nonsense is that? I gave him the shirt on my free will. It's a mitzvah. Free will is not taken away from humans. By the same token, if I choose to kill my friend, we also cannot say, well, why did God bring about his death? God did not bring about his death. I acted in my free will to kill him, just like I acted in my free will to give him a shirt. These things are entirely human products. Now, I see it's already 10, so we're going to have to end here. Next class, we're going to finish up this with Berkowitz. I'll compare him to Richard Rubinstein and Elie Wiesel and talk about a few more things. And we will, I am very confident, by next class, move on to one of maybe the greatest of the Gedolim of the 20th century, Chaim Moser Grudzinski. I'll explain why I mean the greatest. He's the closest thing we had to a pope. Great in both the spiritual realm and the temporal realm. We'll begin dealing with Rav Chaim Moser, with how Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik describes the great Rav Chaim Moser. So we will do that next week. Like I said, we still have another 15 minutes or so about Eliezer Berkowitz and the question of theodicy. It's an important one. I don't know at the end how many of you will be satisfied by Berkowitz's resolution, but all I'll say is, think of it this way. He's not trying to give a resolution. He's simply trying to explain to you how the world works. And it takes a lot of maturity, spiritual and intellectual maturity, to accept that you're not going to have answers for everything. We live in a world where, unfortunately, there's a lot of simpletons out there. Hamonam, obviously not on Torah and Moshe, not listening to us. But there's lots of people who feel that they don't have the answers, but there's some holy man, there's some mystic, there's somebody out there that he has all the answers, and he's going to explain everything to us. And that's not the world. We'll get into this in more detail next class. But let me see, do we have any comments or questions? Stay on for two more minutes. See if anyone's typing here. Okay. This would be a first. If no comments or no questions, maybe you just want to soak it up, soak it in. I will stay on one more minute then. If not, pick up next week. Okay, well, thank you very much. I hope the lack of questions is, as I said, not because you didn't find it interesting or insightful or even challenging Berkowitz's positions, but more that, as I said, you're still taking it in and want to think about it a bit more. So if anyone does have questions or comments, feel free to email me during the week and I can begin next class with them. Good night, everyone.